Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we have the pleasure of hearing once more from Connie Ellis. She was the author of the book we just concluded, The Ice Dancer. We're going to hear a short story today of hers called Portrait of an Artist. You should know that Connie is also a very accomplished visual artist, and this story is indeed partially autobiographical. The story is set in Duluth, and you may appreciate the several Duluth references. After a short musical introduction, we will hear Connie Ellis reading her short story, Portrait of an Artist.
Portrait of an Artist by Connie Ellis. Have you always liked to paint? Yes, I respond, as I mix linseed oil into white. Morris Cantor stands beside me, tall, gray, and old-worldly elegant, his hands clasped behind his back. He likes my paintings, and I like his dark, lonely eyes, set far back in the shadowed caves of his El Greco face. Continue, he says, with a simple but dramatic gesture toward my easel, like God offering me the world. As he walks away, I let my brush glide down the center of the canvas like a lazy fish, its fins flipping at the bottom into an oily alabaster sea. Professor Cantor moves around the circle of painters and easels like a morning cloak butterfly, pausing momentarily by one painting, then the next, before settling beside Sherman, who is working on another dark painting, a continuation of his deep-hued summer palette. His current painting seems mixed, from the colors of lizards and snakes, plus blues, scooped fresh from Lake Superior, still dripping, glistening, changing colors like water at sunset, which he swirls, dips, drags, and leaps into form across his canvas. Even his darkest paintings blaze with light. Sherman mixes paint like an alchemist, conjuring up colors, perplexing colors, colors you need to see to believe, colors you would have to be a genius to mix. And Sherman is a genius. People complain they get discouraged, say it's like being in class with Picasso. But I like it. I like Sherman and his work. I know his girlfriend, and he has a passing acquaintance with my boyfriend. We're comfortable together. Sherman looks over at me, catches my eye, and doesn't let go for a few seconds before he returns to his work. His eyes are a soft jade and a little sly. We've known each other for as long as I can remember, from First Lutheran Church, where we were confirmed together 7 years ago, wearing beautiful white confirmation robes, white as the white on my canvas. But I have no explanation for the communion of spirit I feel with Sherman, the deja vu, as if we spent previous lifetimes together, perhaps painting winged angels and clouds on the ceiling of some fabulous Italian cathedral in Venice or Florence, one of those totally un-Lutheran places of light and gold leaf. Or maybe we were potato farmers in Ireland and suffered the famine year together. Or perhaps we are just twin spirits, two peas in a pod, 2 tubes of oil paint in a set. 2 easels down from me, Bill laughs out loud. I glance over. His posture forms a human question mark, with his pointy nose poked out to within an inch of his painting, till he stands back and squints. He is an intense person. During spring art seminar, when Sherman came in late, Bill exclaimed loudly, but with innocent fascination, "Why, Sherman, you have sleep lines from the sheets on your face." Sherman grinned and sat down at our table. We are all used to Bill. We saw the same unabashed zeal when our class went to the Minneapolis Art Institute during spring quarter. And Bill sprinted up the stairs of the museum ahead of everyone, wild with anticipation to get inside and see all the paintings we had been studying in books. Monet, Renoir, Bonnard, Van Gogh, just waiting on the walls. To the art, 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 his leaping strides seemed to say. Karen says he's a wolf, an art wolf. I swish my brush in turpentine and watch Karen, who is next to Bill. She's painting fast, her white cat face pinched in concentration, and her strokes almost angry. Her long blonde hair hangs straight, covering half her face, which is streaked with purple paint. Karen is the only one of us who is married, and she smokes marijuana. I found out last weekend after a party when she wanted me to try some. I didn't care to, even though people expected of us. Think all of us art students love drugs, that it just goes with our lifestyle, the way we all dress in black and read poetry out loud to each other in the cafeteria. We like Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, and Dylan Thomas, though sometimes we read our own rambling poems. Karen has one about taking a bath, about lighting candles and incense, pouring emerald bath oil like rain, then turning out the bathroom lights and stepping into the dark, oily water of the Ganges. I plan to try this, but so far I haven't been able to find a store in Duluth that sells incense. Morris canters beside me again. His calm smile is my best teacher. I can relax and really paint in his class. Probably he is 70 years old, and here in Duluth from Cooper Union, which is in Greenwich Village, a far leap from Duluth, I'm sure you can believe. He likes Duluth, he has told us, and considers it a fine place to spend the summer. And it is beautiful here on campus, high on the hill overlooking Lake Superior. We have a perfect summer climate, with a cool breeze from the lake and temperatures in the 70s. He studies my painting while I clean my brushes. As I hold my jar of turpentine up to the light, he tells me my paintings are tiny like postage stamps, too small for my mind, he says. Looking at Professor Cantor through turpentine, I promise that my next canvas will be a big one. He smiles through clear blue liquid. After class, Bill offers me a ride, which I accept, since my boyfriend is taking his mother up to the range for the day. Morris Cantor waves to us from the far side of the parking lot, and I wave back while Bill puts a pile of books in the trunk. I had forgotten about Bill's erratic driving, but as we pull out, I am quickly reminded. His method is to drive fast, then brake hard and quick whenever he sees something interesting, which means every few blocks. So we jerk along, stopping first to look at a red Karmann Ghia parked in a driveway. Then a house being painted cerulean blue. Next, a white cat sitting on a tree stump. And finally, we drive right into someone's yard to look at a weeping birch. Bill leaps out of the car and a man comes around the corner and tells us in a loud voice that a bear sat on his weeping birch and split the tree down the middle. So he wound the old hose around its trunk. I get out to look at the tree with Bill. It's a small tree, about 6 feet high. The bear must have sat on its drooping branches, ripping the tree's center with its great weight. We stand before the tree and offer our condolences, and I comment that the bear probably didn't mean any harm. The tree man agrees, and I am moved by his tenderness toward the tree. Bill leans close to the tree like he's trying to hear a whisper. Then he pats the mint green hose, and this seems to finalize our spur-of-the-moment ceremony here on the lawn. As we walk to the car, I feel good, but once inside I'm anxious again, want to get out. I would rather walk. I ask Bill to drop me off at Chester Park, which is just around the corner. I get out of the car at Chester Park, by the ice rink warming house, and watch Bill drive off. He smiles and waves, and sure enough, before he is out of sight, he's made another sudden stop, this time in the middle of the bridge. I sigh with relief as he takes off again, which he does with a noticeable lurch. Perhaps he saw an interesting rock beside the bridge. Maybe he saw a troll. I'll have to ask him in class tomorrow. I follow the dirt road past the ski jumps and around to the clay tennis courts, which are empty, except for the higher single court. I climb to the hill to watch a game between two young boys who are still learning. One has a strong serve, and I sit back on the grassy slope to watch their volley in order to calm myself after the crazy ride. "Have you always liked to paint?" The question repeats itself like the volley. "Always liked to paint? 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 Always, always." The white ball moves smoothly back and forth, bouncing off the court with soft springiness, as if the clay court itself is a third party in the game. "You're talking to yourself," Sherman says, coming up behind me. "I was wondering how long you would last. I was behind you and Bill, a couple of blocks back," he says, as he sits down beside me in the grass. I won't ride with him. I parked up on the hill and cut down through the woods. He's just... I shrug at the futility of trying to describe Bill. The boys are having fun laughing as they leap after the balls. Their good volley has them in a jovial mood. "It's not safe. How can he go through life like that?" I ask, expecting no answer. We both like Bill, and I tell Sherman about the bear that sat on the tree. Sherman can really listen, in a way that reflects back your own comments, magnifying them. "Sherman, did you paint when you were a child?" I ask, as I twist red clover stems into a bracelet. "I like drawing. I was always drawing," he says, as he sketches in the second tennis player. "I did watercolors in high school in Mr. Bindler's class," I tell him, as I slip the bracelet on my wrist. "In the spring, he would take us outside on the lawn in front of the Central High School, and we would paint whatever we saw. Trees, houses, the lake. It was nice and warm, and it seemed like getting out of jail after the long, gloomy winter. I can still see my painting with dark branches and new green leaves, that spring green that's almost lime on cheap manila paper. I did the leaves like this. I demonstrate the dabbing technique with a dandelion. Here, make a sun," he offers me his sketchbook, and I press a sun into the sky of his drawing of the tennis players with my dandelion. His sketch is as fluid and perfect as a Raphael, and it takes some gumption on my part to do as he asks. I hand over the sketchbook as the tennis players end their practice and gather up their balls. They walk off down the dirt road toward the pond, hopping and clowning like two Charlie Chaplins, continuing their hobbly antics as they catch up to and walk behind three nuns in full black habit from St. Scholastica, whose dark forms are clearly delineated against the pale dirt road. "Good image," Sherman says, "the nuns." "Like from a dream," I comment. And feeling the warm sun on my face, I sense Sherman absorb the image of the three nuns, much in the same way as the sun soaks into our skin. "Nuns have the cleanest hands. I always notice that about them," I say. "And nice clean nails, pink nails." "Like shells," Sherman says. He holds his hands out for me to see the paint stains, and I show him mine. We laugh because mine are worse than his. "I have a paint story for you from when I was young," I tell him. "I had a dream about it after the party last week. I have never told anyone, but I've been thinking about it. My first real painting, and I was punished for it. I'll tell you," I offer, I'll tell you on top of the ski scaffold. Sherman stands up, ready to climb, already curious. On our way to the ski jump, he keeps prodding me for clues about my story, but I won't tell him. The boys and the nuns are out of sight by the time we get to the pond, and two mallards swim near the dam. Your colors, I tell Sherman, those birds, as we pause to watch the ducks. He agrees. We carry our shoes and socks as we cross the cement spillway of the dam, and the cold water runs over our feet. We walk slowly in order not to slip on the slimy moss, straining down toward the falls, which is tricky because of the cold, and Sherman says to concentrate. Imagine that we're walking through lukewarm water instead of ice water. On the other side, we sit in the sun just below Rabbit Ears, the smallest ski jump, to warm and dry our feet with our socks. I feel young seeing our bare feet, as if our toes are some sort of secret children, our play selves, and we become older and more serious as we put on our socks and shoes. The path to the ski jump is the old bobsled run through the woods. We pick raspberries as we walk along, and Sherman talks about Morris Cantor. He says he is 68 years old and was born in Minsk, Russia. His mother died when he was 12, and he moved to New York, where he lived with his father. Later, when he was around 30, he spent a year in Paris, studying the paintings in the Louvre. As Sherman talks and we walk along the forest path, I think of our Minnesota woods as the Russian forest, filled with Russian pines, Russian birch, Russian berries. The birds are singing, and I wonder if they sound the same in Russia or France. Do bird calls vary according to country? Do birds have accents? He liked the Futurists and the Cubists, but ended up with his own abstract style, Sherman says. He would make a pencil sketch, work out shapes, dark and light, then start in the center of a canvas and work toward the corners. Sherman stops to pick up a scroll of birch bark, longer and wider than his sketchbook. He examines it, then asks me if I can read it. I laugh and tell him it's a difficult language, probably early Iroquois. He slides the birch bark onto his forearm like a bowstring protector, and we walk the last 100 feet to the top of the hill in silence. His face is like a mystery, don't you think? Sherman comments as we come to the base of the ski jump. His eyes, yes, I agree. Looking up the jump seems impossibly high, yet I'm anxious to start climbing. Something seems peculiar, though, and I notice that the birds have stopped singing, and Sherman is standing perfectly still, as though his entire body is listening to the woods. I get a funny feeling like we are being watched. For some reason, there seem to be too many trees, and they're too close together, and they definitely seem Russian. Even the underbrush of hazelnut bushes seems alien and thick, and I'm surprised to find myself scowling into the thicket. I turn around slowly toward where Sherman is looking. I expect to see something, but I don't know what. A bear? Or Morris Cantor disguised as a birch tree? Sherman's girlfriend? Or my boyfriend? A rustle in the bushes startles us both, and I can feel my heart beating in my chest. I'm sure that if I say anything, my voice will come out sounding like a Disney character, so I keep swallowing. We see him at the same time, a young buck, watching us. Nothing but eyes and a stillness, a moment of connection with the wild, until the deer bounds off into the trees with three thunderous leaps, and the hairs on my arms tingle. Time to climb, Sherman says, and I can see the deer still in his eyes. We've chosen the tallest ski jump, and Sherman goes ahead, straight up. At first, there is only the sound of our feet on the wooden rungs. Then, as we get higher, our breathing and the wind in the trees. I like climbing the stairs with Sherman. Climbing is romantic. Climbing is going somewhere. Princes and princesses climb castle stairs. Rapunzel lived in a tower. We climb step after step, higher and higher. We climb through the wind at the top, and finally we step out onto the wooden platform in the sun. It's like being on top of the world. You can see Lake Superior and the surrounding hills of Duluth, the tops of houses and church towers. a radio tower, and nearby the other ski jump and the dirt road to the cross-country ski trail. St. Scholastica appears like a dark castle at the edge of the woods. And what you can't see, you can imagine. Russia, Paris, Bill's car screeching to a halt before a tall blooming sunflower. Sherman and I walking down the halls of the Louvre. Deer in the forest below. 12-year-old Charlie Chaplin's throwing rocks in the river. Blank canvases waiting to be painted. And my story waiting to be told. Don't talk, Sherman says. Not a word until your story. We'll just be the wind. And we are. We're just the wind while we listen to it blow in the treetops. Warm summer wind, blowing our hair, making the sun shimmer on the big blue lake, blowing through our bones, through the world, through our lives. The sharp cawing of a crow brings us back to ourselves, and I feel ready to tell my story. Sherman tells me to tell it like I dreamed it last week after the party, and I agree, though I think I'll remember the actual event better than as it appeared in last week's dream, even though it happened long ago when I was 5 years old. Sherman sits like a Buddha before me, and I lean back against the soft weathered boards of the scaffolding. The far-off radio tower looks like a tiny Eiffel Tower sitting on the top of Sherman's head. Tell it like you're hypnotized, Sherman says, like you're in a trance. I'm in the basement, and I'm 5 years old. It's winter, and the coal furnace is warm, nice and warm, and I can see the fire through the slits on the sides of the furnace door and by the hinges. I have my crayons with me. I know how the fire looks when the door is open, and I like the flames, the orange flames that flicker like blue tips. I know the sound of coal being shoveled from the coal bin by my dad or by my grandfather, and I know the crooked bunny lives in the coal bin. I'm not afraid. I have my crayons. I use the red crayon first, red like the fire. I melt it on the middle of the furnace door, press the crayon on the hot metal door, and see it melt. Peel the paper. Orange next. Takes time to melt, but you don't notice the time. How did I start doing this? I don't remember. Gold on the silver door, then copper, turquoise, blue, lime green, all the bright colors, dripping, dripping, getting thick and smooth and bright, pink next to black, silver next to red, crayon after crayon, color after color, thicker and smoother until the furnace door is nothing but color, wonderful color, a volcano of color, rivers of color. Purple, orange, green, gold, every color in the crayon box, every color in the world, wonderful, rapturous color. How do I know to do this? You're an artist. You have no choice, Morris Cantor says from the coal bin. My brother was an artist, my grandfather tells Morris. He made his living as an artist back in Norway. My grandfather shows me a photograph of his brother in his coffin, surrounded by paintings. You'd better come out, he tells Morris, who comes out of the coal bin. My grandfather brushes him off with a big yellow broom, then shows him the photo of his brother Carl in the coffin. My father comes up behind them. I have to punish her. Someone has to do it, he says. Nice, though, isn't it? It is, Morris Cantor says. A lot of talent, and still so young. I have to scrape it all off, all the crayon, until there is nothing left but a ghost image on the silver of the furnace door. By the time I finish, they're all gone, and it's just me and the furnace and the coal bin, which I'm no longer afraid of, because the colors are inside me. I'm 5 years old, and I'm a box of crayons. I'm done, I say and look to Sherman. Thank you, he says, and I see that I've enchanted him. And I'm not sure if I had meant to do that. I can only look at him for a few seconds, but I can see for certain that's just what he wanted. Time to go down, I say, standing up and starting for the steps, knowing I need to break the spell, get us back to our other lives, back into our regular lives, if I can. The end.
You've been listening to Portrait of an Artist, by writer and artist Connie Ellis. If you happen to miss any of the episodes of The Ice Dancer in the last couple of weeks, or you'd just like to hear them again, they are all posted on our website, ktwh.org, under the program's menu item across the top. The drop-down list includes Literally from the North Shore. You can tune in next week, starting Monday, December 7th, to hear Katya Gordon read her book, Big Waves, Small Boat, Two Kids, A Family Sailing Adventure. And now we'll close with a song by Joan Baez, De Colores, In Colors.
Are you a fan of Literally from the North Shore? I know I am, which is why we're on a search for someone to organize and produce this show. If you want to continue to spend your lunch hours hearing local or other authors read books, and if you would consider the role of show organizer and producer, please contact us at KTWH, 218-595-6195. Don't let this gem of a local show go off the air. We look forward to hearing from you.